Let's go over to step three. Made a decision to turn our lives and our wills and so many good things in between. We made our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood Him. Behind this step and a principle that I want to put into my life is faith. And we'll see that mentioned over and over in our 12 and 12 when it talks about step three. Practicing step three is like the opening of a door which to all appearances is still closed and locked. All we need is a key and the decision to swing the door open. There's only one key, and it's called willingness. Just be willing to believe and make that decision that our life would be better off and our wills would be better off if we just put them in somebody else's hands. The door opens almost to itself once unlocked. And looking through it, we shall see a pathway beside which is an inscription. And it reads, "This is the way to a faith that really works." In the first two steps, we were engaged in reflection. We saw that we were powerless over alcohol, but we also perceived that faith of some kind, if only in AA itself, is possible to anyone. These conclusions did not require action. They required only acceptance. I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to go through any rituals. I didn't have to do any specific thing to make this decision that, okay, I'm going to turn my will. And I didn't have as much problem with that. And he points that out as he goes on here because he saw that this was a stumbling block. I didn't have so much trouble turning my will over to God because, and I see it done over and over today. Well, I know God will solve this problem for me. You and I know that sometime Alcoholics Anonymous didn't promise me in the beginning and never has promised me to solve all of the problems of my life that come up. It never promised me that. But it promised me that I could handle any problem that came up in my life. And that's what my decision there has to be. I was willing to take that will and, you know, okay, I won't be so hell-bent for China to do all these things, you know, to quit. I'll try to put that will and keep that will under control and not be so controlling and not be so demanding and not be so hard on other people and on and on and on. But my life, didn't know about that. Didn't know whether I wanted to turn my life over to the care of God. What made me a little bit shaky, because I couldn't see myself on that street corner with that tambourine. I could see myself in the strip joint in a tambourine, but you know. But man, I didn't know whether I wanted my life turned over to God or not. The will didn't scare me as much as the other part of that. Life and our lives, the will and our lives, over to that care of God. Second paragraph, it says, like all the remaining steps, step three calls for affirmative action. For it is only by action that we can cut away the self-will which has always blocked the entry of God. Or, if you like, a higher power into our lives. Faith, to be sure, is necessary, but faith alone can avail us nothing. Just having faith that God's going to work this out for me. And sitting and waiting for God to tell me, no, this is not really, and He makes it real clear in our 12 and 12, that faith alone is not going to get it done. We can have faith and yet keep God out of our lives. Therefore, our problem now becomes just how and by what specific means shall we be able to let Him in. Step three represents our first attempt. God, Bill, gave us lots of room. He knew Himself and He knew alcoholics so well that He knew that none of these can be done. The only one that is required to do 100% is step one. all the rest of our steps, he makes it very clear that all we need to do is to give them a go. And when we look at that, it's not something we have to get done. I hear people say, you know, they've handed their will and their life over to the care of God, and then they just keep taking it back. Taking it back. Have you ever heard anybody say that in meetings? Okay, look what he says about that. We can keep God out of our lives. Therefore, our problem now becomes just how and by what specific means shall we let him in. Step three represents that first attempt to do this. In fact, look at the next promise. The effectiveness of the whole AA program will rest upon how well and earnestly we have tried, not how well we have gotten it done. But he says we have tried to come to a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. To every worldly and practical-minded beginner, this step looks hard, even impossible. No matter how much one wishes to try, exactly how can he turn his will and his life over to the care of whatever God he thinks there is? Fortunately, we who have tried it and with equal misgivings can testify that anyone at all, can begin to do it. When I'm teaching, I tell the kids, take their pencils, and there's certain ring around words, and those are the ones I'm emphasizing, and you better believe those are the sentences that are important. But that's one of my ring around words there. Anyone at all can begin to do it. We can further add that a beginning, even the smallest, is all that's needed. Once we have placed the key of willingness in the lock and have the door ever so slightly open, we find that we can always open it some more. Now look at this. Though self-will may slam it shut again, as it frequently does, it'll always respond the moment we again pick up the key of willingness. So see, when I'm sitting in a meeting and they say, you know, this program is just not working for me. I just can't take that step three. I just can't do it. Bill tells us here, begin. Just for a day, get up and say, you know, my will and my life is in somebody else's hands today. I'm going to do all the footwork down here. But the outcome of this day, we just try it for a day, then we're willing. Just try every time that will say, I'm gonna make him do this. I'm gonna see that they do that. Go to your job and I ain't gonna put up with that stuff anymore. I'm gonna tell them off today. Just put that off for a day and say, you know, I'm gonna go to work and I'm gonna do my job to the very best of my ability and leave everybody else alone. That's the key of willingness, that we just try to leave that strong will that the only person that knows how to do this job is me. And it's my job to get all these other people straightened out. And of course, I always started with my man. I always knew that I could do it, you know, everything a little bit better than he could. And naturally, my back was up because he could drink better than I could. So I began to pick at other things. I was still wanting my will imposed on that man of mine. And of course, being the, thank God, the beautiful, strong man that he was, he just kept saying, uh-uh, very firmly. But if we just, all that's asking us to do, they say that, you know, to every one of us, it seems impossible to just take this step. And that's true. A lot of people, the progress of different ones of us is different. Some of us are more pliable and can do this in more rapid order. We can come to believe that our lives and our will are strictly in God's hands. And then there's some of us that are not doing too pretty good at it. But Bill gives us room here, doesn't he? In other words, all really all in very simple terms, and he makes it, oh gosh, he gives us so much in here that helps us with this and that I can use to help my new girls that come in. So many suggestions, like, you know, the fact that, no, honey, you don't have to take this before you leave here tonight. You don't have to take step three. Step three is taken by trial and error. Decide on that day to just let God be in charge that day. You do all the human stuff, but just ask Him in the morning to be in charge of your day. I know I got in the habit early when I finally sobered up to ask God, God, help me keep my thinking straight today. And I knew that was a powerful favor I was asking Him, because my thinking can get crazy in real short order. But when I got into the 12 and 12 and I realized that it was backing up what the big book had already told me, but in just more depth and width, as Bill says, that he's trying to do here, to give us the idea that no, we don't have to take it. I don't have to demand of my girls that they take it. All this step is really saying to me that if I get up in the mornings and I say to this power that I believe in, I can say, God, you know, I don't know what the future holds. I don't know what this day holds. But I know who holds the future, and I know who holds this day. That I have made my beginning on step three for this day. And the longer I work on it and see the peace and the contentment that's come into my life, by keeping on with that step three and trying to keep it shining in my life, try to keep that faith that, Willie, don't worry about it. You don't really have charge of this day. You're responsible for the worldly things, yes. And if you do your job to the best of your ability, if you're the best wife that you can be, if you're the best mother that you can be, if you're the best employer that you can be, then the outcome of this day is going to be okay. Because I know who holds the future of this day. I know who holds how it's going to come out. That's what step three is. If you do work with a lot of people, look and see what that step three are, the suggestions that it has for us. At the end of step three here on page 40, it says, it's when we try to make our will conform with God's that we begin to use it rightly. To all of us, this was a most wonderful revelation. Our whole trouble has been the misuse of willpower. They're not asking us, you know, you're going to have to turn into a jellyfish and you don't have any will. When you use your will, you're just not, you just shouldn't have it. Throw it away. Get rid of it. What makes up a human being? Will. And he tells us, you know, reminds us here, it's not the use of our willpower, it's the misuse. I didn't have any business messing in this man's life that I was married to. We weren't joined at the hip, we just got married. I didn't have any business trying to get him to quit drinking, and baseline was so that it would make it easier for me to quit drinking. I was determined that he was going to quit. Wrong again. He was determined he wasn't. And I wanted this man. It was Willie that had to put the old will to the right use and use it on Willie, not on him. That's the right use of it. Willie, you're married to a man you love. He's everything you've ever wanted. Okay, you gonna bust this thing wide open because he won't quit drinking? That's the misuse of will. Won't you take that will of yours and use it right? And be determined that whether he drinks or not is not gonna disturb your sobriety. It's not gonna disturb your peace of mind. It has nothing to do with your problem. Because see, my man read this big book and he handed it to me. And he said, Willie, you got a problem. and you better solve it. And it seems like this book has a lot of answers in it for you. And then he was through with the subject, completely through. So I could use that will either way. I could misuse it by he will quit or I'll leave him. Who would I have been hurting? At this point, I think he would have helped me pack. We had tried to bombard our problems with it instead of attempting to bring it into agreement with God's intention for us. I think God's intention for me was to get sober and stay sober. My husband wasn't in the picture at all. He didn't have anything to do with it. I had to have that honesty. See, I'm carrying over all these principles that I've been trying to get working on. To make this increasingly possible is the purpose of AA's 12 steps, and step 3 opens the door. It is really easy to begin the practice of step 3. In all times of emotional disturbance or indecision, we can pause, ask for quiet, and in the stillness simply say, God grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change. The courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thy will, not mine, be done. See, when I left that man of mine alone, and I made up my mind that I don't care how successfully he drinks, I don't care how much booze is in this house, if I don't want it, nobody could even hold me and pour it down me. And you know, it's worked out just like that for the last 37 years. It was in my home. My husband didn't embrace this program. You men are very fortunate in many ways, because your wife will go into Al-Anon and she will get her program going and she'll turn into this beautiful butterfly and everything's going real good. But have you ever seen an Al-Anon room crowded with men? That was something I had to accept. And make it all right. Make it all right. We have some men in Al-Anon. God bless them. I'm proud of them. But the majority of our men are going to tell us, uh-uh. And I think the baseline on that is that my man didn't want to be reminded of my drinking and some of the things that happened. He didn't want to be reminded of that. He followed the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. He cooperated without affiliation. In 37 years of my sobriety, he never went to an AA meeting. He never went to an Al-Anon meeting. He never went to any conventions with me or anything. This was my deal. And dear God, it didn't take me long to find out that's fine. That's fine. I didn't have to be belligerent about it. I didn't have to change him. He could stay home and drink his beer or his martinis or whatever he wanted while I was gone to a meeting. And see, as long as he didn't, and he did not interfere, I could get up at 3:00 in the morning, go on a 12-step call. Anything I wanted to do in this program, I could do. But he wanted no part of it. And God bless him, he got all the fallout for 37 years. All the good stuff. Because see, as I became a better person, then I became a better wife. Later I became a better mother. So by not keeping on making him try just through will, you know, just you will get this booze out of the house, because it's hard for me to walk by it all the time. It's hard for me to clean out that liquor cabinet. It's hard for me to open the refrigerator and, you know, stare that beer in the face. Just the fact that it was hard didn't say it was impossible, was it? And those men kept telling me, Willie, when you decide to get sober, his drinking won't matter one way or the other. And it didn't. It didn't. It made it harder. That's okay. I think with this good German stock here, God knew that if, with this hard head I already have, I was born with, that if he didn't make it a little difficult, I might not do it. He knows each one of us so well. He knows what we can handle. He knows what we can handle. And what will, by handling it, will make a better person out of us. And see, I can help those women that come and say, my companion, my husband, won't stop drinking. I said, that's all right, honey. Doesn't have anything to do with you. You can. And I know you can because I can. I've done it. That's the value that we have. There's no power on earth greater than the power of one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, saying those two precious words, I understand. I understand. Tell me about it. And I'll tell you, I'll share my experience with you. And it's lifted a load off of many a gal that was really angry about the fact that their husband would still drink at business dinners, whether he drank all the time or not. But he would still come in from a business dinner and, you know, she could smell the wine or smell whatever. And it was ruining an otherwise good marriage. I'm not talking about a marriage with other problems. That's not what I'm talking about. You know what I'm talking about. And that's what step three is talking about. You know, our little serenity prayer is so beautiful, and I always like the fact that he chose to end up step three. Step four. The principle that we put in here is action. Let's get busy. Right up here. Let's put it into action. Action and courage, because any action takes courage. Anything we do takes that courage, that I think I can. I'm going to give it a try. And along with courage, we always know that I might not be able to do it. But I'm going to give it everything I've got. And that's where we bring the honesty, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Our big book does a beautiful job of telling us how to do our fourth step. All our little 12 and 12 does, and a lot of people, like I say, they throw up a block about the 12 and 12, not realizing that it's a complementary thing. That it goes on and expands on the big book. He gave us the most beautiful paragraph here that I've ever seen that tells us how to start on step four with what attitude I'm to begin step four with. And he said, creation gave us instincts for a purpose. Without them, we wouldn't be complete human beings. If men and women didn't exert themselves to be secure in their persons, made no effort to harvest food or construct shelter, there would be no survival. If they didn't reproduce, the earth wouldn't be populated. If there were no social instincts, if man cared nothing about the society of one another, there could be no society. So these desires for the sex relation, for the material and emotional security, and for companionships are perfectly necessary and right and surely God-given. These are basic instincts that all men are created with. We all want to be secure in our persons. We all want to have the things in our lives that make us feel secure and protected. That's a God-given instinct. They want us to feel well towards our fellow man and to feel a sense of belonging. We want to reproduce the earth. All of these are God-given instincts. And he reminds us that every one of us possess these. But when you take an instinct and get it out of kilter, this is when it's going to hurt you or the regular Joe walking down the street out there. He puts it so well when he says, yet these instincts, so necessary for our existence, we can't really exist without these instincts, often far exceed their proper function, powerfully and blindly and many times subtly, there's the word, They drive us, they dominate us, and insist upon ruling our lives. Our desires for sex, for the material and emotional security, and for an important place in society often tyrannize us. When thus out of joint, man's natural desires cause him great trouble, practically all the trouble there is. Now, did they tell us that when out of joint, the alcoholic's natural desires cause him great trouble? That's not what it says here in my book. It says man's natural desires. So they're telling us once again, you're a human being, Willie. And I don't care how far you are away from a drink. These natural, God-given instincts are here today as they were back then. And those are the ones that I've got to keep on as even a keel as I possibly can. Balance, balance, balance. If I get them too far this way, if I get them too far this way, I'm going to be out of kilter. Man's troubles. And he says that practically all the trouble there is. And he says no human being, not alcoholic, no human being, however good, is exempt from these troubles. Nearly every serious emotional problem can be seen as a case of misdirected instinct. When that happens, our great natural asset, the instincts, have turned into physical and mental liabilities. When we try to not just be, you know, around here, balance. When I go to my job and try to, you know, make everybody else well aware that I am the best teacher in that building, that you girls just out of college, you don't know from nothing. And these kids are going to take you and turn you every way but loose. Now, those thoughts might go through my mind once in a while, and I sort of feel sorry for the young ones coming in there. But the thing of it is, that social instinct, if I'm going to do any guidance, I have to do it gently. I have to keep the instinct, the social instinct, in my mind. That yes, I can really get these young teachers told, you're not doing it right. And what am I going to do with a natural, God-given desire of a social instinct to be well-liked and to be well-thought of as I behave in my actions that are brought on by my thoughts? It says, step four is our vigorous and painstaking effort to discover what these liabilities in each of us, and look, it says, have been. That means all the way back there, and are. I like the way he puts that, because not only did I have to look back and see, Willie was, you know, was lying, has it always been a part of your nature? Have you always, and many people, have had that big old empty hole from the very beginning that they can remember, and that alcohol filled up that hole and gave them confidence that they'd never had and gave them a feeling of well-being that they'd never had. But any time we put that word all to describe all of us, we're not helping ourselves and we're not helping the people that we're trying to help. Because I had never had that feeling of not belonging, of not being accepted. I had always been outgoing. I'd always liked people. Hell, there wasn't enough people in Spring, Texas to dislike. You know, there just wasn't that much choice. We were all kissing kin. I grew up feeling good about Willie. I went off to college and felt good about Willie. I had a ball in college. I'd gone on to Houston, started teaching school, and I was having, from the first 6 weeks of teaching school, I knew that was the only thing I ever wanted to do to make a living. I married a man that I wanted real bad, and I was real satisfied with my choice. I made a good choice. But see, I had to find out, hey, Willie, that have been back there doesn't mean anything. Sure, you've always been outgoing with people. I've never been the shy, retiring, violent type. I always was one that, you know, wanted to put on the war paint and go raid the village. I was ready to go. Anytime anybody said go, let's you know, go to the dance, let's go here, let's go there, I was ready. And I always felt good. There was nothing in my childhood had made me. I always was one that, you know, wanted to put on the war paint and go raid the village. I was ready to go. Anytime anybody said go, let's you know, go to the dance, let's go here, let's go there, I was ready. And I always felt good. There was nothing in my childhood had made me feel any different. And it is different with people that have always had this feeling of not belonging. Their circumstances were different, but I must not, when I'm dealing with my new gals, I must not put them in, like so many people that are studying us, put them in these little holes in an egg carton and expect them to fit. We're all, from Bill says, we're like those passengers on that ship. So it's in step four, that's what I'm after. Our big book tells us how to get it, to put these things down in their columns. Put those resentments down. Write down all the people that we resent. They give us good directions. And in this 12 and 12 are so many added suggestions that Bill had come up with in that 12 and 13 year interval. He had come up with a lot of them. And I hope that you, and I know many of you are as familiar with this book as I am, but those of you who are not, take note of some of the things that he says in step four. On page 48, he talks about falling into confusion about what all of these things are called. He said, to avoid falling into confusion over the names these defects should be called, let's take a universally recognized list of major human failings, the seven deadly sins: pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, and sloth. Fancy word for lazy. Let's look at those. If you don't know where to begin, if you don't know how to really get a gal going that's still sort of vague up here, you can take those and start, because they give her an idea of some of the things in her that are out of balance, way out of balance. For pride leading to self-justification, and that's where pride will lead you, and always spurred by conscious or unconscious fear, is the basic breeder of most human difficulties. Fear. Ring around. Fear. The chief block to the progress. True progress. Pride lures us into making demands upon ourselves and upon others, which cannot be met without perverting or misusing our God-given instinct. If I would have continued to try to make that man bend to my will, you know where the marriage would have been, down the tube. When the satisfaction of our instinct for sex, security, and society becomes the sole object of our lives, then pride steps in to justify our excesses. And look at this next. All of these failings generate fear. And look how it describes fear, and see if you don't agree with it. A soul sickness in its own right. When we become afraid about the future and what's going to happen to our jobs and what's going to happen to this and what's going to happen to the whole world seems to be going crazy. And this fear, and we have to watch it now more than we've ever had to watch it, because the world is going a little bit wacko. Man's inhumanity to man nowadays just absolutely... it can cause us to fall into this fear. The fear of, you know, doing things that I used to do without even thinking about it. Getting in my car at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night and scooting someplace. I don't do that anymore. But see, there's healthy fear too. And it need not be fear. I can turn it into caution. And I can't jump in that car and go across the city of Houston anymore like I did when I was growing up there. But I can turn that into caution and not fear of what's becoming of the world. Where is it all going to end? I don't have to make a big drama out of it. I can look at the fact that it's no longer real smart for a woman to get in the car and run around at night by herself in a big city. It's just not the smart thing to do. I heard that. I do not ride my motorcycle at night by myself anymore either. Because fear, as he describes it here, that's soul sickness. Because fear can make you sick all over. It can make you physically sick. That unnamed fear out there of the unknown. It can make us mentally sick, and dear God, it can make us emotionally sick. Then fear, in turn, generates more character defects. Unreasonable fear that our instincts will not be satisfied drives us to covet the possession of others, to lust for sex and power, to become angry when our instinctive demands are threatened, to be envious when the ambitions of others seem to be realized while ours are not. We eat and we drink and we grab for more of everything than we need, fearing we shall never have enough. And with genuine alarm at the prospect of work, we stay lazy. We loaf and procrastinate. Now, we can rationalize that procrastination is not a form of laziness, but 'tain't true. If I got a closet in my house that needs cleaning real bad, it's gotten to the point where I don't even want to open the door. So I just keep passing by it. And I said, well, now, I'm gonna do that next week. I'm going to go put that on my list right now. I'm going to do that next week. And I keep on putting it off. And I keep on putting it off. A year later, that closet is still in a terrible shape. And that's not because I haven't had time to jump in there and clean that closet out. That's pure laziness. That putting it off and putting it off and putting it off, that's where the seven deadly sins of just plain old laziness comes in. And all the time, every time, and you housewives know this, you gals that keep house, every time you pass by that closet, there's this little pang that hits you. And we bury it, and we walk by in the pang, and we bury it. And God, aren't we happy when we get in there one day full of, you know, what and vinegar, and we get in there and we throw everything out of that closet, put back just the things that belong there. Man, when we close that door, don't we feel good? You men feel that same way when you fix your car, when it's been a banging and a clanging and making strange noises. And you just haven't had the time to get up under the hood and see if is there something flapping or loose or gone or what. You feel good when you get it fixed. You feel a little bit more secure when you get in the morning and start to work. That laziness can really get us done. Said, we loaf and procrastinate, or at least work grudgingly and under half steam. These fears, I love this sentence, I love them. These fears are the termites that ceaselessly devour the foundation of whatever sort of life we try to build. And see, this is what our defects will do to us if we don't look at what they are, pinpoint them, as our directions in both books give us a way to do that. I hear people say, I just don't know how to take step four. There's directions in the big book, beautiful directions. There's some further directions and helpful hints here. Tells us how. And unless we don't have the ability to read, and even then we can't get by because we can find somebody to read it to us. All these books are in Braille. There's no escape once we really want to get serious with this thing. We can do. All right, now what do we do? And oh man, it hurts me. Step five, quickly. And I got time. The beautiful principle of integrity is here's where we start putting that back in there. If we've never had it, we put it for the first time. If we've lost it, the integrity of dealing with life on its terms, the integrity of dealing honestly with every situation that we possibly can. admitted to God and to ourselves and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. This is where this principle starts taking place in our lives. And it tells us all of AA's 12 steps. All of AA's 12 steps ask us to go contrary to our natural desires. They all deflate our egos. When it comes to ego deflation, few steps are harder to take than five. But scarcely any step is more necessary to long-time sobriety and peace of mind than this one. I want that long-time sobriety, and I want that peace of mind. And if I'm going to get it, and if I want my girls to have it, I have to emphasize to them that after that step four, it's not soup yet. It's not done yet. We got to put a little bit of integrity into our lives and be willing to face what we are, what we have been, by leveling with God and ourselves and another human being. There's something therapeutic about looking in. I remember when I looked into my beautiful Rose there in Alabama, in Montgomery, in her eyes, and did my step five with her. Those eyes heard along with me, and they shared along with me. And it lifted such a great load, not right in the beginning, not as I was doing it, but as I was trying to live on, you know, along. The realization that I wasn't alone in this thing came to me in step five. That I really wasn't alone. I not only had that one beautiful human being that I was sitting there looking into those eyes, but I had a whole bunch of other human beings and a whole bunch of eyes to look into for the rest of my life that would understand Willie and that would try to help her in any way they could. This is where I got that feeling. It says, AA's experience has taught us that we cannot live alone with our pressing problems and the character defects which cause or aggravate them. Those key character defects are human defects, remember? Still got them. And they can be aggravated as a human being living in the jungle that we're living in nowadays. It's an okay jungle. I'd rather be here than out of it, that's for sure. But I can still aggravate these character defects. And by admitting them to God and to myself and to another human being, that keeps me more on the alert because if I share that with one human being, when the time comes, I can share it with another. And even if I never verbally share some of my fifth step, I can share the idea, the good feeling. Make a comparison of some sort to help another person. And it gives me a feeling of, you know, I'm getting clean. I felt like I'm getting clean here because I felt so dirty, so dirty. If we have swept the searchlight of step four back and forth over our careers and it has revealed in stark relief those experiences we'd rather not remember, if we have come to know how wrong thinking and action, notice not just action but thinking, my thinking can get me into just as much trouble as acting on my thinking if it's wrong, have hurt us and others, then the need to quit living by ourselves with those tormenting ghosts of yesterday gets more urgent than ever. We have to talk to somebody about them. They reinforce all of the suggestions that they give us to be cautious, to make sure that we put our trust as nearly in someone else that we can have a lot of faith in. There's a lot of folks around. And this is step five is terribly hard for us women to do because it's our basic instinct not to trust each other. That's not alcoholic women, honey. That's women. And that's something that we don't do on purpose. That starts way down in first grade. Watch your young'uns. Watch little kids and watch the gals. I've watched those little first graders when I would have that in the elementary schools. And I'd watch them. And after about the second day of school, they'd pair off in their little groups. And this group over here didn't have anything to do with this group over here. And all this little group, if you're my best friend, you can't be her best friend. I don't want you to have anything to do with her. Hun, that's a basic part of a woman's nature. We started way down. Nobody teaches us that. To not trust each other. That's an underlying cross we have to bear. But by George, we can pick up that cross and run with it. We can change that. And the beauty of learning to love other women is something to behold. It's something that will add a dimension to your life that a lot of women around you won't ever know that joy. Because we're working against something that's normal for us to do, and that's not be comfortable telling a woman too much, because we don't ever know how much is going to go out the other way. And I know some of you men are pretty good at passing things along, but I think you all will all admit that we outdo you. And it tells us all the steps to take to be cautious about and have faith in that person. I had absolute faith by that time in one human being, that woman there in Montgomery, Alabama. I knew that when I told her, gave her my fifth step, and she shared hers with me so lovingly, that it was in the vault. It was in the bank vault. And there it stayed. But it tells us, you know, how we can go about getting this feeling and that what to do in case we can't get it about each other. But I felt like I was so fortunate that I did find that woman. And so many times, you'd be surprised, after you know a woman well enough and have watched her, does she walk like she talks? If you do want to do your fifth step within the bounds of AA and with another alcoholic. I watched Rose. I listened to her talk at meeting, but I mainly watched. I watched how she treated the new woman that walked in the door. That she didn't do what is normal for women to do, and that's... I'm going to hold off a little bit here, and I won't give her my phone number. I'll see how things go. I'll see if she really means business. And that measuring stick, because we can communicate a message, us gals can, to each other with a look. And y'all know about that look. A new woman walks in and just watch the expression, especially if she's a real good-looking babe and about 30 years younger. You know, we just can look at her and make her feel less than. And when we begin to build this faith with each other, then we're going to be automatically better to every human being that comes into our path. All these things will come back to us. They'll come back and haunt us. And it's sort of after we finish our step five and we begin to see what these things are that later on we're going to be asking those to be removed. But first, you can't remove anything. It's sort of like trying to take a stain out when we don't know what caused the stain. You have better luck taking it out if you know what it is. Because there's certain things you shouldn't put on, say, blood stains, or certain things on mustard stains, or certain things on anything with grease. And if you... There's no sense in doctoring something or trying to fix it if you don't know it's there and what it's composed of. Is it fear, Willie? Is that what's so out of balance with you? Is it guilt? Is it pride? Is it ego? And this, in that fifth step, this sort of helps us clear the way to really take on step 6 and 7 and 8 and 9. Because, you know, our first three steps, 1, 2, and 3, we're getting right with God, with our higher power, if you will. In 4, 5, 6, and 7, we're getting right with ourselves. In 8 and 9, we are getting right with our fellow human beings. And in 10, 11, and 12, we're growing. Those are our growing steps. So in this step 5, our attempt to get right with ourselves, not taking what other people have done to us or what they're going to do to us or what they might do to us. But Willie, what's your problem? What's your problem, honey? Let's make a list of your problems and let's talk to somebody about it. And that takes the sting out of them. Then I don't have to live by them all by myself. Don't have to live with them. Okay, I know you've been beautiful. You've been so patient. And it's harder to sit and listen than it is to stand up here and talk and listen. And y'all have been real faithful. The real stout-hearted ones will show up again at 2 o'clock this afternoon. So I'll know who's a faint heart and sore seat when you don't show up. That's be all right. So let's break and eat, and then I'll see you back here at 2 o'clock. Thank you, honey.